Hi, welcome back to Breast Cancer Briefing, the podcast where we are breaking down the latest in breast cancer research and science, one conversation at a time. And we are here at the Miami Breast Cancer Conference, where you can hear all the buzz around us. There's been amazing sessions the last couple of days. And I am very excited for the guest who is sitting with me here to talk about a really huge topic right now that is affecting all of our patients coming up all the time in clinic. So with me is the co-director of breast oncology and director of cancer survivorship at Emory University Winship Cancer Institute. His research focuses on optimizing metabolic health and lifestyle to improve cancer risk and outcomes. He has done research looking at structured exercise programs and nutritional interventions, as well as the use of drugs that treat metabolic disorders like GLP-1s. He's really a world-renowned expert in this topic. So I'm so excited to have Dr. Neil Iyengar with us. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So glad to talk to you. This, I feel like, comes up in every single clinic nowadays. Like every day someone is asking about so many questions about lifestyle, all these new medications on the market. There's so much misinformation out there as well. So I'm really looking forward to hearing from you, your take on some of these things. So I think just to start out, I've kind of been asking everybody, I love to just get to know you a little bit and for people to get to know you. Do you mind sharing with us, how did you end up as a breast oncologist? Like, what got you here?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So I've always had an interest scientifically in hormone signaling. And, you know, it started in college where I was in a lab that studied testosterone biosynthesis and aging. And as I went to medical school and did my clinicals and really started to like oncology because of the patient care, it's a really sacred space that we enter with the patient. As I started my fellowship, my other sort of passion, my lifelong passion, has been lifestyle and how to optimize our lifestyles to live well. And just at the time I was starting fellowship, we were recognizing that obesity is a major risk factor for several cancers. And the research was very early in those days. And we were starting to understand that some of those links had to do with hormone signaling, inflammation, and so forth. So breast cancer was the ideal place scientifically for me to bring together all of those interests. Hormone signaling, in this case now shifting from testosterone to estrogen, although nowadays we're sort of shifting back to testosterone. And then bringing in the lifestyle angle. And then also breast cancer patient care was really appealing to me because it really felt like a partnership with my patients, really invested patients. So all of these factors together made breast cancer the right place for me.
No, I love hearing just how people got to where they are. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. And you already kind of hit on some of the things that I can't wait to ask you more about. I think just to start off, to give people a little bit more foundation, I wanna just start with the physiology of estrogen in the body. You know, our patients who have hormone-driven breast cancer, the backbone of treatment is blocking the estrogen in the body. And we know that those endocrine therapies, they're life-saving for our patients, but our body also needs estrogen. And so when we take that away, it affects so many different systems in the body, and our patients feel that. Could you talk a little bit more about, like, what are the kind of biggest things that we see when patients are on these endocrine therapies?
Yeah, absolutely. Your point is so well taken. And I think part of this comes from we're now learning more and more about the intricacies of estrogen signaling. Mm-hmm. For example, we know that there are different types of estrogen, right? So E1 or estrone, that's the pro-inflammatory estrogen that may not be so good for us, whereas E2 is the more protective estrogen. Unfortunately, we don't have a way yet to parse out what we're blocking with our anti-estrogen therapies for breast cancer. And so you get a conglomerate effect of all of the anti-estrogen therapy that we're using. And that is associated with several adverse effects as well as long-term metabolic effects. And my research area focuses on some of those metabolic effects. So we know that when you lower estrogen or you block estrogen signaling, this can ultimately lead to cardiometabolic dysfunction. And that includes things like cardiac disease, a higher risk for diabetes, a higher risk for having inflammation that can then promote more diabetes. Mm-hmm. We also see effects, negative effects on bone health, mm-hmm. quality of life, of course, lack of estrogen yeah. can lead to so many symptomatic issues. So putting all of this together, while the benefit of surviving breast cancer still right. does outweigh some of those adverse effects, I think it really highlights an opportunity for us to develop adjunctive strategies to reverse some of those negative effects of anti-estrogen therapy.
Right. I think so often in clinic, when I am seeing a new hormone-driven breast cancer patient that's early stage, we're talking about starting endocrine therapy, big question. They're like, I hear I'm going to gain weight. Mm. And certainly not everybody does, but it's the big thing people worry about. Why do these therapies lead to weight gain? Can you talk more about what's happening there?
That's a great question. And, you know, the honest answer is we don't completely know mm-hmm. or understand the mechanism. And what's intriguing is when you look at the old randomized controlled trials that looked at anti-estrogen therapy yeah. and those who were not on anti-estrogen therapy, either in the prevention setting or in the treatment setting, everybody gained weight, including in either the control arm or historic controls. Mm-hmm. And I think that has to do with many women who we're treating for breast cancer are actually undergoing menopause or they're in the perimenopausal phase.
Right.
And that phase itself is associated with weight gain. So I think essentially what we see is the natural history of aging. And for many women, that is associated with weight gain. Parsing out whether or not that is due to the estrogen therapy can be challenging. And I think it's not so much that the anti-estrogen therapy directly causes weight gain. It's that we're inducing yeah. a postmenopausal state, an estrogen-deprived state. Mm-hmm. And that goes along with all of the mechanisms we were talking about earlier,
right.
like inflammation, like cardiometabolic dysfunction, and adipose tissue dysfunction. So when you disrupt all of those processes, that's going to lead to weight gain and make it harder to lose weight.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so true. I feel like it's a spectrum for sure. And I try to tell that to patients, you know, just because you're taking this drug does not mean you will gain weight. Like I don't want people to think that's a slam dunk. But you already had mentioned like some of the other metabolic effects as well that we see like on cardiovascular health and things. Do we have a good understanding on what is going on there? Or what do you know about
yeah.
all of that?
That's a great question. So we're learning more, and it comes back down to the different types of estrogen, as mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
So again, some estrogens can be inflammatory, some can be anti-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. We also know that estrogen signaling not only is parallel, but has crosstalk with metabolic signaling, like insulin signaling or insulin growth factor signaling. And so it's essentially disrupting energy homeostasis in the mm-hmm. body. Estrogen is involved in energy homeostasis in the body. And when you disrupt that, then the body tries to re-implement homeostasis, right? And so this can overcompensate and this can lead to hyperinsulinemia, for mm-hmm. example, or the lack of estrogen in certain scenarios can induce inflammation, or the presence of only E1 and maybe not E2 can be associated with more inflammation. And then the baseline characteristics of that particular individual, if somebody right. already has borderline cardiometabolic dysfunction, blocking estrogen signaling mm-hmm. might be the thing that pushes them over into clinically significant cardiometabolic dysfunction.
I was going to ask you just that, like who should we worry about? Who's going to be most at risk of developing all of these complications?
Yeah, I love that question because that really highlights the need to do more precise risk
right.
stratification, right? We've used body mass index for the longest time, and it is generally a helpful and easy tool, right? If somebody has a body mass index of 30 or greater, their risk of relapse is higher, their risk mm-hmm. of treatment resistance is higher. In fact, we're learning that that risk may actually start at a BMI of 27 or greater.
Wow.
But in our research, and now several other groups have found this as well, even in women who have a normal body mass index, but higher percentages of body fat, that's a risk factor. That's called normal weight obesity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a risk factor not only for developing breast cancer, but increases the risk of recurrence. So ultimately,
yeah.
I think what we need is a fat and metabolic signature to more precisely risk stratify who's at risk.
Yeah. And I wanna ask you too, you already kind of had alluded to it before, but how, so we're giving patients a drug where we could be putting them more at risk of all these metabolic disorders, gaining weight, obesity. So our patients who do end up with obesity or other metabolic disorders, how does that then affect their long-term outcomes?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, we know, unfortunately, that breast cancer survivors are at more than a doubling of risk of developing diabetes and mortality from cardiometabolic diseases. But we also now know that those individuals that have obesity or hyperinsulinemia or high body fat levels have a higher risk of breast cancer recurrence. Mm-hmm. And that is across all subtypes of breast cancer. We see that for triple negative breast cancer, HER2 positive, ER positive breast cancer. So it really is a risk factor for cancer, poor cancer specific outcomes.
Yeah, it can be a struggle to feel like we're giving you a drug to try to improve your outcome, but then we're also potentially giving you side effects that might compromise that outcome. So it's definitely a struggle that we find ourselves in as oncologists.
Well, and I love that you say that, because one of the things that I like to highlight is if you look at chemotherapy cohort studies, nearly every single metabolic parameter worsens after adjuvant or neoadjuvant chemotherapy, yet that chemotherapy is life-saving.
Right.
So I sort of view it as an opportunity. If we can correct that metabolic dysfunction, perhaps that survival benefit of chemotherapy will be even more profound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and definitely I think we're excited. We're seeing lots of new data with new drugs that can be helpful tools for us, which we're going to get into. But I wanted to hear more about some of the research that you have done. What types of like diet interventions and exercise interventions have you focused on in some of the studies you've designed?
Thank you for the question, because I really feel passionate that we can use lifestyle interventions precisely and as medical therapy. Mm-hmm. So we've taken a drug development paradigm to develop precision lifestyle interventions. Okay. And what I mean by precision lifestyle interventions is that I don't think that there is a one size fits all approach. We may not be or should not be recommending the same diet for every single person. It depends on their treatments, their baseline characteristics, and so forth. Now, there are general patterns that I think we can recommend to the population as a whole, but in clinic, we can be very specific about the lifestyle interventions that we're recommending. So part of our research program is looking at how do we identify factors that can then guide what specific type of lifestyle intervention we recommend for that patient. You know, when a patient comes in for their breast cancer treatment, we don't hand them a tote bag of pills and say, here you go.
Right.
But we do that with lifestyle interventions. We hand them a brochure of diet and exercise. Those are all very specific interventions that we can prescribe. Mm-hmm. So our research program is looking into how we do that more precisely. And then how do we do that as you would use a medical therapeutic? So we're looking at phase 1 dosing studies. We've just completed a phase 1 dose finding study of exercise in the metastatic setting. We're doing the same with diet. So we're comparing low carbohydrate diets versus ketogenic diets. That's essentially a carbohydrate dosing study.
Yeah.
Plant-based diets. So ultimately taking a precision medicine and drug development paradigm to the development of lifestyle interventions.
That's amazing. And so true. Like, why do we think that just general recommendations work for everybody? One thing that I struggle with in clinic, and I'm sure you face it too, and I would love to know how you approach this, but you know, I always try to encourage my patients, like, you know, exercise and nothing crazy. We're talking like we see benefit with just walking, you know, something weight bearing, just trying to encourage them to stick to exercise, you know, cleaner diet, rich in whole foods and things like that, that are, you know, easier concepts for someone to grasp in a shorter clinic visit. But then we recommend exercise to help with the fatigue and sometimes the joint pain people have. But then when my patient's like, I'm too tired to exercise, like I'm telling you I'm tired and you're telling me to exercise, like, are you crazy?
Right.
How do we approach that with patients? Like, do you have a good tactic that you've learned through your clinic and research?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, I mean, I think the first thing that I want to highlight, because you, I think, very importantly raised this point, is we have to think about what is the indication for our exercise recommendation, right? Are we recommending exercise because we want to treat a specific symptom that patient is having? Is it fatigue? Is it pain? Is it vasomotor symptoms? Or are we recommending exercise to treat the development or developing cardiometabolic disease, for example, prediabetes?
Okay.
Or are we recommending exercise as anti-cancer therapy, right? Because I suspect the type of exercise, the dose of exercise will vary between the indication for exercise.
Okay.
So if a patient is complaining of fatigue, which we know is very common during the adjuvant setting, then I would say most of the current exercise guidelines have actually been developed to address fatigue and symptoms from our therapies. So the ASCO ACSM guidelines for 150 minutes per week of exercise is really directed to symptom management, maybe not some of those other indications, right? And so that's where I start, is really trying to understand what are we addressing with the exercise and how can we best dose or select the appropriate modality of exercise for that indication. And then that there's the challenge of, if you are addressing fatigue, how do you overcome that, right? So I really tell folks that it's really the activation energy, right?
Right.
It is a huge struggle to get a fatigued your fatigued self to get up and move.
Yes.
But the return on investment is huge. And if you don't feel that benefit that first day, you'll likely feel it that next day. But on the flip side, if you remain sedentary, that compounding is also huge. And that fatigue is going to get worse day after day after day. So I think that's the first call to action. The second piece is we do initially need to meet patients where they are. I'm a big proponent, as you've heard, of dosing exercise, and I have goals for patients. But I'm not going to throw somebody into high-intensity interval training on day one if they've not been exercising, right? So most of our exercise trials, even the dosing trials, have a ramp-up period to get to where they need to be. And then finally, we need to find an exercise modality that brings joy to patients, right? If we're prescribing aerobic exercise, there are many different ways you can get your heart rate up, right? And so exploring that with patients, bringing in exercise professionals into the clinic, like exercise physiologists or physical therapists or occupational therapists who can help with those modalities of exercise that are joyful to the patient, can be really helpful.
Yeah, I love some of those tactics. And in trying to drive home the idea that, yes, it's so hard to start, but once you get into it, like, we will see the benefit. I have to tell myself that some days, like we've all been there.
Yes.
So I know how challenging it can be. I want to kind of shift a little bit to the big hot topic on everyone's mind, is we have a lot of new drugs now that can help reverse some of these metabolic issues, particularly all these GLP-1 drugs. This last December in San Antonio, we had a whole session on data for weight management and GLP-1s, which was really exciting. We had great sessions here that you gave on that. Before we get into some of that, how will you explain, what are these drugs?
Sure.
Like break it down for us.
Absolutely. So these are considered to be incretin mimetics. And basically what they do, as the name suggests, is they replicate our endogenous signaling in terms of hormone signaling, essentially to maintain glycemic homeostasis. So what is so helpful about the GLP-1 receptor agonists is that they don't only cause insulin secretion, for example, because in a hypoglycemic or euglycemic state, you may not want insulin secretion. In that setting, they don't cause insulin secretion. In a hyperglycemic state, you do want some insulin secretion. And so what's useful about these drugs is that they really modify signaling based on homeostasis, maintaining that homeostasis. They also reduce gastric emptying, and so that helps with the feeling of satiety or feeling full. There's additional data suggesting that they centrally modify hunger hormone signaling, so you feel less hungry. And we're now learning that there are so many tissue-specific effects as well. They appear to help brain health. They may have a positive effect on bone health. Now, we are seeing negative effects on skeletal health, and or skeletal muscle health, I should say, and
I'm sure
we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, what they do is they maintain glycemic homeostasis, they reduce gastric emptying, and they reduce hunger.
Do we see evidence that they help reduce inflammation in the body, or is that more of a secondary effect from, you know, just improving weight and overall health?
That's such a great question. So we're seeing more and more evidence that they do help to reduce inflammation.
Yeah.
I don't think we know yet definitively if that's a direct or indirect effect. Mm-hmm. We do certainly see when you reduce the amounts of adipose tissue, that reduces systemic inflammation. Now, whether these directly reduce inflammation, I think ongoing studies and preclinical data will help to address that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I've been seeing a lot of this preclinical data suggesting that, which is really interesting. These drugs, you know, some of the big brand names that people are familiar with, the Ozempic and Zepbound, Wegovy, you know, there's a slew of them out there now. Are there differences in some of these we're hearing, and then maybe some even newer ones in clinical trials as well?
Yeah, there certainly are differences. So there are the single GLP-1 receptor agonists, okay, and then there are the dual GLP-1 GIP receptor agonists. Okay. And those so far appear to be a little more effective in terms of inducing more weight loss than the single GLP-1 receptor agonists. We're now starting to see actually triple agonists that also target the glucocorticoid receptor as well. So some of the newer agents may be even more effective for more weight loss, but we'll see how the data pans out. And then there are now emerging oral therapies as well, because of course these have all been injectables up until now, but there are oral therapies that are now coming out as well that are even more convenient.
I'm glad you brought that up too. Do we know anything about if there's a difference in efficacy between the injectables and orals? I know that's been something a lot of people are talking about and wondering as a patient.
Well, so far the orals are single GLP-1 receptor agonists, but there are duals that are under development as well. And so I don't think that we've seen convincing evidence that the orals are less effective than the injectables, just keeping in mind that there are differences between the single and dual receptor agonists.
Okay. Another thing too is I feel like there's this notion that these drugs are new and we need to do so much research on them. But in reality, I mean, the first GLP-1 agonist was approved like 20 years ago.
Yes.
We've been using them for a really long time to treat diabetes. What do you think is driving this sudden, I feel like this new kind of interest in these drugs all of a sudden? Like, they've been around for a long time. What shifted, do you think?
You know, I think that part of it is the recognition of all of the negative effects of obesity. And, you know, I'm happy to see this shift that these medications are now in greater use. And I think part of that shift is because the original indication for GLP-1 receptor agonist was to treat diabetes.
Right.
Right. And so I think as experience grew with using these drugs, and there was more data showing the greater amounts of weight loss that you see with these drugs as opposed to other anti-diabetic medications, then that led to the hypothesis that perhaps we should be using this specifically to treat obesity.
Yeah.
And that's where I think we've really seen this field take off as as obesity medicine has also taken off.
I know, that's so exciting. There is one thing that can come up for people. They have a black box warning. Will you talk about that? What is a black box warning for?
Yeah.
And where did that come from?
Yeah, so the black box warning for thyroid cancer.
Yes.
And, you know, in some of the original studies, there was a higher rate of thyroid cancers in patients who were treated with these medications, the GLP-1 receptor agonists. I think that several groups have gone back to parse out this data. Mm-hmm. And it's not quite clear if that is simply because of the natural incidence of thyroid cancers. And these tended to be the less aggressive, more straightforward to treat thyroid cancers. There have been several large observational population data sets that have also looked at this question and have not found an increased incidence of thyroid cancers. Now, the data are mixed because there are some data sets that do show an increase in the risk of thyroid cancers as well. So I think ultimately there probably is a mildly increased risk, but we don't know for sure.
Okay.
And what's interesting is we've seen some recent data sets that were reported at ASCO and now published, which have shown that these medications reduce the risk of several cancers, mostly obesity-related cancers.
Yeah.
And those studies did not find an increased risk of thyroid cancer. So ultimately, I would say the preponderance of evidence suggests that there may not be an increased risk of thyroid cancer. And if there is, it's probably very low.
Yeah, but it's really been thyroid cancer specifically. I think that's the key. People can get associated with all different types of cancer, but really it's a specific type
It's an important question because there is one study that came out of the Florida Cancer Database. And in that study, there was a numeric trend for an increased risk of kidney cancer. And it was not a statistically significant risk, but there was a trend. That has not been replicated in any other study. And I don't have a great explanation, biologically speaking, as to why that might be the case. So I think, again, if we put all of the data together, the protective effects seem to be much more apparent than risk of these cancers. And if there is a risk, it's probably small and mostly related to thyroid cancer.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. I'm glad you mentioned that. And it does just kind of, it's worth noting, like, you know, as researchers, something that gets thrown around a lot, this notion of causality. Mm. When we're doing big population-based studies, you kind of alluded to it already, just because something is more common in that population does not necessarily mean it's related to whatever the intervention was you're looking at. So I think we have to be really careful drawing those types of conclusions and you know, putting them out there. We have to be really thoughtful in how, what the type of study is and how we can design other studies to better understand that.
Absolutely.
So,